everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood. And welcome to Make Me Smart. We are back from low, what felt like the longest absence ever. Low, our long vacation. We are joined on this podcast, as always, by all of you. Because, people, none of us is as smart as all of us.
This is the much and long-awaited book club week, the Make Me Smart book club edition number one. It is, despite my protestations, actually, for another book, it is The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, Thomas Crowe, by the way. I'm going to mispronounce the guy who gave me the pronunciation. Thomas Crowe is the psychology graduate student who wrote to us and said, listen, you're pronouncing Jonathan Haidt's name wrong, because we had been saying Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. It is actually Haidt. Now that we've gotten past that messy introduction to the book, let me say it again. The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion by Jonathan Haidt.
I feel like if Jonathan wrote to us and told us that to pronounce it that way, then I would buy it. But I don't know, Thomas. Well, no, I'm just kidding. Okay, Jonathan Haidt it is. And yes, at long last, we finally finished the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we are ready to discuss. Let's get right to it.
How to start a book club.
Books are fun.
I have my own book club.
Oh, I just can't wait to read a book.
Is that like, what's that from? That last little, oh, I just can't wait. Is that like, that's got to be PBS something, right? Barney, oh.
To
God.
Read a book. It does sound pretty PBS.
It's very Barney-ish.
I like the British girl.
Yeah, no,
I have my own.
That's right. So, Jonathan Haidt, he was for a very long time at the University of Virginia. He is now at the Stern School of Business at New York University, where he says, actually in point of fact and some other stuff I've read, that he wants to bring these ideas of moral psychology to business, which I think, wow, good luck, yo. anyway, you want
to? I can't wait to have that conversation.
Give us the précis there, would you, Ms. Wood?
The précis?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the deal with The Righteous Mind. It is essentially an argument. It's a book about moral psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Haidt is arguing that people are responsive to these six moral foundations, basically: care, fairness, liberty, loyalty, authority, and sanctity.
Okay, whoa, you took way better notes than I did.
Oh, I did. I was like, Kai's going to stick me with the summary, so I am on it.
You totally took better notes than I did.
There are sort of themes related to those that carry moral weight that people respond to. And he spends a long time with sort of the history of moral psychology and how we think. Some of the important themes in there are that reason is overrated, that we are actually largely driven by intuition.
Yep.
That group behavior is an evolutionary trait. But that it is tribal and parochial. Our instincts are basically to defend our own groups, and that there are all of these group level adaptations that produce trust and cohesiveness, among them being religion. And my kind of favorite repeated analogy that he uses is that we humans are 90% chimp, that is, you know, fundamentally self-interested,
mm-hmm.
and 10% bee, that
right.
we need hivish behavior to kind of bind us together, and that's actually an evolutionary trait that helped us survive.
So that is,
that's the setup.
Right, that's the setup. My favorite, just to keep going with the animal analogy thing, and so I'm gonna summarize it my way, which is this. This is 445 pages, basically, 450 pages, that basically, in my very gut-oriented mind, boil down to, yeah, we humans, we decide with our guts, and then we rationalize it later.
Right. But what's interesting is that he also talks about, though, that we decide very different things with our guts.
Right.
And that, so the part where the good people divided by politics and religion come in are what arguments appeal to which moral foundations.
Mm-hmm.
And so his central political argument is that the arguments of the left, or liberals, appeal almost exclusively to care and fairness.
Yep.
And exclude liberty, loyalty, authority, and sanctity, whereas conservative principles, and we'll get into later why that's not necessarily the same as current Republican principles, but conservative principles tend to appeal to five or six, much more. And that when it comes to kind of bridging that gap, you know, there's all kind of interesting things that go into that. For example, that liberals are more closed-minded about listening to conversations about loyalty, authority, sanctity, and liberty.
Right.
And it gets fascinating.
Well, we should touch on all of this right now because I don't know if we, I don't know how far back to it we want to
get. Let's do it.
But so here's the deal. Basically what he says, if you want to get it to the politics of the day or just to politics, is that the Republicans connect on all six of those foundations. Democrats connect on only two. And that is why, in essence, Republicans have been kicking Democrats' butts for years and years and years.
Yeah.
Because despite the fact that Republicans might not have, how to say this delicately, Republicans might not have a reputation for care and fairness, they connect on other things. And that's why people gravitate to them.
Mm-hmm. And that it's and what's really what's profound about this is that he's arguing that, like, look, everybody involved here has a moral matrix that makes sense to them. So that when liberals argue that Republicans are only motivated by money and you don't care about people, don't care about victims, don't care about oppression, that that's just not true. That there is, in fact, a corresponding moral matrix that makes sense. And that needs to be recognized if you're going to have a good discourse. Now, what's also interesting, though, is that he has this sort of moment where he says, I contrast this pretty strongly with the Republican Party in particular, which he argues has now, you know, he says the conservative arguments make perfect sense. Like he says, people, conservatives believe that people are inherently imperfect, prone to act badly. And he says, yes, our reasoning is flawed and prone to overconfidence, so we can't construct theories based on pure reason. Absolutely. Institutions are really important. And if we strip them of authority, we expose ourselves to social disorder and unhappiness. You know, all of that, he says, is true. And then he talks about how the Republican Party, though, it has mostly sacralized taxes.
Right.
And that means no trade-offs and that they're willing to sacrifice a lot of the good things government can do to preserve low taxes for the wealthiest Americans. I don't know if that undermines his entire argument or if it's just worth noting in terms of the parties, which I think it is.
I think it is worth noting. I think what you have to do here is you have to separate out what's going on in the Republican Party in the United States today versus traditional small C conservative thought, right?
Yeah.
Which is not where the Republican Party seems to be being taken today. And I think that's an important disclaimer and qualifier.
Yeah, exactly. There's a pretty intense footnote where he essentially lays the current political hyper-partisanship at the feet of Newt Gingrich.
Yep. And, you know, he's not the first one to do that, by the by.
And skips on past it. Well, yeah, no, I mean, he lays it there, you know, as a result of hearing from members of Congress on both sides. But so I think as people read this, I know that some of the reaction was to say, it's interesting because one of the things he talks about is the liberal intractability in terms of hearing about these other four moral foundations. But I know that there were people reading this who were saying, yeah, but the Republican Party, this, that, and the other thing. So I think it's an important distinction to talk about what he says about conservatism and parties.
Which gets to, so I said it boils down to your gut figures out what you're going to do in my, you know, pea-sized brain. Here's the other part of it, though. And I think really the subtext of this book, and it'll be curious to get him on this podcast. And we called him, by the way, and we couldn't. He's into it. We just couldn't make it all line up. So maybe we'll get him down the line. Empathy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Empathy matters. And he talks about Dale Carnegie, the you know, Dale Carnegie winning friends, influencing people and, you know, modern speaking bureaus and all that jazz. As being a guy who really got it. If you want to be persuasive to the other side, which is fundamentally what politics used to be about in this country and what politics in a functioning democracy is, and yes, the subtext of that is that we do not have a functioning democracy right now, but the subtext of political discourse in a democracy is being able to persuade the other side to your point of view. And the way to do that, Jonathan Haidt says, is to be empathetic, understand where they're coming from, devote time, energy, and attention to that, and then make your reasoned argument. And do it knowing about these six foundations of moral psychology and all of that, and then try to get inside their brains and sway them to your point of view. And what's happening now in the political discourse is that we're talking past each other.
It's interesting, too, because we'll just get through all of our thoughts and then get some ears and react to yours too. Because we got, thank you, by the way, in advance for all of the amazing reviews you sent us. What's interesting in a New York Times sort of analysis of this, it asked the question, But to whom is Haidt directing his advice?
Wait, you did outside reading?
Yeah.
All right. Well, so did
I didn't mean to be a jerk, so, you know. But although as a result, I only finished the book like literally 15 minutes before we started the podcast. We were in this race the whole time. It was a little horse race, you guys.
I was losing for a long time. And then Molly went away on vacation and I buckled down and I would.
Which is exactly when I maybe could have done it. And I just, let me just be honest, I did not. But he says, if, you know, reason is self-serving and if intuitions don't allow us to reflect, who's gonna read this and have this magical moment of reasoned enlightenment that lets us seek out, you know, other groups so we can build empathy? I mean, sort of there's not a lot of solutions in here, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
That's a really good point, actually. There aren't a lot of solutions. And in point of fact, that's a really good, oh my God, you with the freaking insights. That's really, really good because he just lays out all these things and how we think and why we think this way and what some of the issues are. And he doesn't offer this is really funny. He doesn't offer a solution. The last line of his book is, we're all stuck here for a while, so let's try to work it out.
Right.
If I could do the shrug emoji in a podcast, that's what I would do right now.
That's exactly it.
And I hope he still comes on, but still.
Wah, wah.
You're like, meh.
I mean, to be fair, there are some broad suggestions about
that is true. It,
trying to improve empathy. And he and his fellow researchers have actually created a website, civilpolitics.org. Which is to try to help organizations do program evaluations. And he talks about creating a more civil social media feed. But again, it relies on you having the kind of reasoning, the interest in reasoning that would propel you to go there in the first place. And that's kind of a tough argument. And then can we talk about the soul crushing part?
Yeah, would you? So, all right. So the backstory is before we turn on the microphones, Molly said, yeah, this is a good book. I really enjoyed it. You know, learned lots, but there was a soul crushing part. And I'm like, what soul crushing part? Because clearly I didn't read that part. So go ahead.
Well, okay. So as I was reading this book, I kept asking myself this basic question, which was because he's going all the way back to more, you know, moral psychology and the foundation of reason and intuition and how we think and all of this stuff. Yep. And then there was never a point where he said, well, there is eventually. I kept thinking, yeah, but why do some people think this way and other people think this way? Like where, if so much of this is evolutionary, where does the division come in the first place? And then in like the third to last page, he tells us it's freaking genetic.
I missed that part.
That literally liberalism versus conservatism is genetic. Conservatives genetically react more strongly than liberals to signs of danger, including the threat of germs and contamination, and even low-level threats such as sudden blasts of white noise.
Wow.
People who tend to be more liberal are less threat-sensitive and more responsive to, for example, openness to experience and diversity.
So we're screwed.
Well,
that's what you're saying.
It is hard not to see it that way. And then he talks about how, because he has this whole thing about how we're kind of, we start out with a foundation that doesn't necessarily have to be predictive. But if you have the sort of genetic makeup that trends you in one direction or the other, that society is going to respond to you in different ways. So if you're, you know, he gives the analogy of a brother and sister. If the sister is more interested in these types of experiences, then certain teachers will respond to her differently. And if the little boy is more responsive to authority and loyalty, then he might end up playing sports and he might, you know, and it can kind of like direct this entire path. And he's like, but it doesn't have to turn out this way. And I think, how the hell is it not going to turn out that way?
Wow.
If it is genetic.
All right. Should we get some voices on here?
Yeah.
Let's get some voices. Here we go.
Hey, Kai and Molly. The book was probably the most informative and interesting book I've ever read, while simultaneously being possibly the worst read of any of the books I've finished. I recently finished my MBA, and I have a big love for economics, so this book presented the human mind in a way that isn't present in business education, with the possible exception of behavioral economics. In sum, great information, really out of the box, at least to me, theories about how people think. Terrible read. Thanks, Seth Johnson.
It felt textbooky to me and a little bit, not pompous, but just dry. Life is too short. There are better books out there and better, you know, I could be listening to a podcast.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Chris Roten in Boston, Massachusetts. Finally finished The Righteous Mind this last weekend, and I have to say that I think it may be one of the most valuable books I've ever read. It really sort of helped me frame differently how I'm thinking about the positions of people I disagree with politically, and I've really found myself identifying the six moral foundations in the speech of others when I'm listening to them. There's one moment in the book, though, where I thought, huh, that's what Twitter may be missing.
Yeah.
That point was when Mr. Haight was speaking about group evolutionary theory and how, in our history, when people acted badly or outside the moral norms of a group, a collection of people from within would shun or, at the extreme end, remove those people from the group. People then evolved to be more sensitive to those group moral dynamics, mostly because the jerks weren't around to procreate with. So I guess what I'm saying is that as social media has become our new group collective, maybe it just hasn't been around long enough for us to selectively remove internet trolls from the gene pool.
Hi, this is Vincent from Los Angeles. I certainly wouldn't have come across The Righteous Mind on my own, so thank you, Make Me Smart, for getting me to read something outside my usual sphere. Listening to the book, shout out to the Make Me Smartin, who suggested using an audiobook, I was really struck by how disconnected human behavior is from rationality. I like to think of myself and those around me as being eminently rational beings, and it was depressing to realize how much that's just a pleasant fiction. And speaking of depressing, The Righteous Mind really didn't offer much in the way of solutions. I was constantly passing on horrifying little factoids about psychology to my wife, but I don't think there was a single time when I came back with good news. From the book, it sounds like the greater good basically caps out at pretty small measures of great, so that was another hit for someone who likes the idea of Star Trek-level global cooperation.
Seth Johnson, Karen Waddell, Chris Roten, and Vincent Selhorst Jones there. So a couple of quick thoughts. It was a tad dry, and it was not my cup of tea, shall we say, book-wise. But I got some stuff out of it. I mean, you know, it was a hair painful, but it was, I think it was a valuable experience to think about how other people think, I guess, is the name of the game.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I had a paradoxical reaction to it, which was like, I'm having a really hard time with this in terms of actually reading it. But I'm bookmarking every page. You know, yep. I mean, there was a lot. So it's sort of, it's like school. Look, this book was a little like school. It's not the funnest thing you're going to do, but you're going to get a lot out of it. And I definitely think I did. That horrifying little factoids thing is like the
yeah.
funniest.
Well, that's clearly, he thought the same thing you did, right?
I mean, I guess solution-wise, the question is, are we, if groupishness is our built-in evolutionary behavior, is there a way to expand the size of the group?
Yeah. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and then the other point about social media, right?
Yeah,
which is that we can all be our worst selves, and it's just, well, it's not helping. We all know that, right? I mean, yes, news and interconnectivity and all that jazz, but holy cow, at what social cost? That'd be a high social cost. More voices?
Yeah, let's do it.
More voices, go.
Hi, Molly and Kai. This is Kendria. I wanted to let you know that I just finished The Righteous Mind. This book definitely deals with some complex concepts, so I really appreciated that the author summarized the key points at the end of each chapter. But
yes,
you know,
I like that too.
By the time I was halfway through the book, I found myself stepping outside my own moral matrix. And now instead of quickly saying, what's wrong with them? I find myself thinking, sounds like their loyalty switch was triggered. Or maybe their sanctity switch was triggered. Anyway, thanks for challenging my thought process and making me hopefully smarter. And Kai, I'll check out The Man in the High Castle next.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or Amazon Video. Do that.
Initially, I found the book hard to get into, but I was ultimately intrigued by the research Haight cites. Here's the problem, though. The book only confirms what I feared. In short, it seems like a zero-sum game. One side will prevail and the other will fail, and I don't really see a way to reach a mutually acceptable compromise on most substantive issues. Haight articulates the problem convincingly, but nothing in his book seems to point toward a solution. I want to believe the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was right when he said that the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. But right now, I am hard-pressed to believe it, especially when our country seems to have irreconcilable definitions of justice. So excuse me, I'm going to go call my congressman and then cry into my beer.
What kind of beer?
It has helped me in my political anxiety just to be able to get in an argument on Facebook and turn it into a positive experience, which I've done several times since starting the book. Yeah, it's not that I am trying to change anyone's mind, it's just that I'm trying to ask enough questions to get to an agreeing point.
Hi, this is Allison Carter calling from Marietta, Georgia, and I want to thank you so much for this. What a great pick it is. I'm reading it very slowly because to me it's a very, very dense book with a lot of information to process, and I read a little each day and process it, and I get so excited about the information every day that I take my aha moment and I share it with everyone I know who will still listen, and even those who won't still listen. My big takeaway so far, and I'm only about a third of the way through it, is that I've gained more compassion and I finally understand somewhat how when I see black, they see apples. Thanks again, Allison Carter, Marietta, Georgia.
Once again, that was Kendria Mochia, Kay Gilbert, a listener with a funny Twitter handle, and Allison Carter. Wow, when they see, I love that. That was great. That was a great analogy.
Black and apples.
To this question of solution, I just put this little note, which is like, well, maybe thinking about it is enough.
Right.
Is it enough for him to say, if you read this book and you encounter someone on the street and you use what you have learned to understand them better, maybe that's enough.
Yep. No,
at
totally.
Least for the, you know, at least in the short term.
Totally. And this, you know, there's no book that is ever going to give you an answer unless it's like a how to prepare your tax forms book. But here's the other thing. And I think it was Kendria Mochia, the first woman who talked about the arc of the moral universe. Mm-hmm. The catch is that the arc of the moral universe, in the full quote, is long, but it bends toward justice, right?
Yeah.
And what Haidt is talking about in this book is not going to solve what's going on in Washington now, what's going on in the Middle East now, what's going on with the Russians now, any of that jazz, right? It's all about getting that mind to a more righteous and not in the praise be sense of the word, but in a more rational and understanding sense of the word. That's my takeaway.
Yeah. Well, and if anything, this book, I think, quite specifically argues against what the parties, and arguably one party in particular, are doing. Right. I mean, creating hyperpartisanship deliberately is fundamentally not what this book is about and fundamentally not what he is arguing for.
And is not
going to help. Is only, in fact, going to lengthen the arc.
Yeah, he's not at all saying that it is going to lengthen the arc. Let me push back just a hair. And go to my empathy point, which is this. If you watch Fox News or if you read conservative Twitter, they're not the ones who are being partisan. It's those damn liberals who are making a mountain out of a molehill and all of this jazz. So I think that's part of the secret handshake with this book, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, yeah, that could be a much longer conversation.
It totally could be. And I get what you're saying. I absolutely do. However, comma. More listeners.
Okay. Hi, Kai and Molly. My name is Callie, and I'm a millennial from Austin, Texas, who's currently living in San Diego, California. My biggest critique of the book was that someone's score on the Moral Foundation's questionnaire seemed to depend heavily on the wording of the questions themselves. I wonder if the results for liberals would be different if protecting the climate was heavily emphasized as a form of sanctity, or if the scientific method was emphasized as a form of authority. I've certainly heard plenty of arguments from liberals about trusting the authority of scientific data and scientific consensus.
This is Eli recording on a walk with my dog in New Orleans, Louisiana. More and more you read and more you think of the metaphors, it helps all of this dense material kind of soak in and you can get a bigger picture. I was having a discussion with my wife about a fight that I got into with my mom the other day, in which I took probably not the tactful tone that I would have liked it to have taken. And it occurred to me, and so I said aloud to my wife that I was letting my elephant meander without any advice from the rider. And she kind of looked at me like I was crazy, but it's just an example of how that metaphor was able to sink in over the course of the book. And I was able to understand the material a lot better.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Dave from Boston, Massachusetts. I think it's really tough when an author tries to smash together different fields and expects the reader to follow along. So I thought there were too many concepts and that they didn't necessarily intertwine. A rider on an elephant, his tongue with six taste receptors, a beehive, and then a morality switch, or the hive switch, excuse me. And I think that's, you know, that's a lot to keep in your head at once. Certainly a challenge, and if you buy into it, I think it paid off very nicely at the end, comparing people, conservative folks and progressive folks, and why society might need both. But I should probably read it a second time to absorb more, but I won't.
Yeah. Amen, brother, because I am not reading this book a second time either. That was Dave Walker right there at the end. Also, Callie Meyer at the beginning and Eli Gay in the middle. Here's my thought, though, on there were a lot of metaphors. There was a lot going on in this book, but it was driven around this theme, right? And I think he stuck pretty closely to his theme. He explained it all, and he did provide those neat little summaries at the ends of the sections, which was oh so handy.
Those were lovely.
Yeah. But what I thought was interesting, actually, was that Callie Meyer, the millennial, the self-described millennial, read this book and dug it and thought it was interesting. And, you know,
I also love what she has to say about the questions and the phrasing and could you turn sort of climate change into morality? One, which reminds me that one of the things I found really profound about this book was the entire conversation about religion and I am sure it is could be a very divisive point of view to say that, you know, gods and religions, I'm quoting, are group level adaptations for producing cohesiveness and trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that what groups get out of religion evolutionarily and in terms of society is belongingness, not necessarily believingness. And when they have a high level of belonging, they behave better as members of society. They are more charitable, they are more giving, they are more helpful within their communities because they have created sort of a system of group pressure. But what was really interesting is that they found that groups that don't have a god as an organizing principle, like more secular communities, don't have the same level of cohesion. That there has to be something sacralized for the benefits, the societal benefits to occur. Which I think is really interesting in terms of Callie's points. It's like you can't turn science into God.
Yeah, I'm not the right guy to talk about the cohesive benefits of religion because I'm not a religious guy. But you can see that in those communities, I guess. And that's where I think is where my comments on that matter will end. You know, just cut.
It's fascinating. Yeah. He says that like the first atheistic societies have only emerged in Europe over the last few decades. And so we're going to see what happens when societies forego the exoskeleton of religion. He says, so far, those societies are the least efficient societies ever known at turning resources, of which they have a lot, into offspring, of which they have few. The religion chapter, I may read again, actually. It was super interesting.
All right,
we have more listeners because, like I said, you guys are the best, and you just kept it coming. So let's get to their voices.
Kai and Molly, this is Mary Apicella from Granby, Connecticut. I am a repeat reader of The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, and I am so excited that y'all are reading it. I first read the book in 2013 when the government shut down the first time was going on, and it was an incredible eye-opening book to help me understand all those folks on the other side of the aisle and why they could possibly think shutting down the government was a good idea. And I've read it again in the lead up to the 2016 presidential election as a pastor now, and being able to better understand and relate to folks in my congregation for whom our political differences became a lot more important and obvious as November the 8th came and went.
Hi, this is Stephen Pelliser from Atlanta, Georgia. Jonathan Haidt's presentation of his core moral psychology study was rigorous and fascinating. His technique of walking the reader through the evolution of his experiments, results, and conclusions is not only insightful, it was very compelling. The concept and identification of six moral foundations was interesting in their own right, but also powerful, practical tools for analyzing human behavior. I found myself trying to use the framework when consuming the news after reading the book. My biggest critique was the contrasting lack of rigor and care when he explores different algorithmic systems such as genetic evolution, hive and swarm behavior, and iterative game theory. These are areas that I have a lot of interest in from the computer science perspective. I found most of his discussion in this area as hand-wavy and constantly reducing everything to very weak connections to genetic evolution. Overall, I liked the book very much. While I found myself flogged with some very tired analogies, I did end up being made smarter.
Hey, this is Jonathan out of Jackson, Mississippi. I am calling. Well, I am speaking to you to say that I did thoroughly enjoy the book. However, I must concede that I read it several years ago. It was definitely a good book. It opened up a lot of doors for me. You know, it really helped me think about the way that I think about thinking. So, read on. It gets a bit more juicy. It's certainly no Man in the High Tower, but it does get more interesting as Haidt begins to apply these principles to modern day political philosophy and how we approach different political parties, spheres, groups, tribalism, you know, really navigating how we evolved as a species, you know, from the very beginning all the way to how I'm voting at the ballot box. Y'all have a good one. I appreciate the show.
Certainly no Man in the High Castle now. Come on, yo. That was great. That was worth the price of admission right there.
That really was. That was Mary Apicella. You have your tribe, I'll tell you that.
That's right. That's right.
That was Mary Apicella, Stephen Pelliser, and Jonathan Gufria. We had roughly 1 million more great emails and voicemails. I mean, it was fantastic. It just, if anything, it showed us that book club works and we're going to keep doing it because it was just fantastic. So we're going to make a whole separate blog post and put some of those in there. I thought, I like that comment about the arguments around group evolution. And I wondered, because one of the things he said was that it totally fell out of favor as an area of study in, I think, like the 60s. Hmm. And I wonder if there's a sort of weak research because of that, because he's almost trying to reassert group evolutionary theory as something to be taken seriously scientifically again.
Hmm. Can we pause here for a minute so I can push back on my own pushback to your pushback about the partisanship?
Totally.
Okay.
You've just been sitting there thinking about
it. Well, I have. While I was listening to all that tape. So here's what I meant. If you take a minute and look at the political operation in this country from the Republicans' point of view, everything they are doing seems to them to be completely rational. You go back to Mitch McConnell saying early in the Obama term, first term, my job is to make Barack Obama a one-term president. That, from his perspective, as leader of the Republicans in the Senate, was the rational and, in his mind, I'm sure, moral thing to do. You look at him blocking Merrick Garland. Ditto. He believed he was doing the right thing for his side. Now, whether you step back and you look at the bigger picture and you believe that that's the right thing or not, I don't actually believe that that was the right thing. But just in terms of the genesis of some of where we are literally today with, you know, mm-hmm. It's Tuesday and we're recording and this Donald Trump Jr. email stuff and all that jazz, where we are today has its roots in that. It was a rational sense of partisan politics from his point of view. Again, I'm not saying it was rational, that now has resulted in where we are today. And that's what I meant. So,
I think that's totally true. Yeah. I think that's 100% true. It's all coming from a point of view. I'm just saying that I'm not sure that point of view is completely in line with conservative principles been historically laid out.
Absolutely.
So it is 100% in line with the current Republican point of view. Yep. I'm only sort of furthering that distinction because I think that there are Republicans who fall in line with the conservatism as laid out in this book and as laid out by historians, and that frankly they're becoming a different party. Well, you know, this is my weird. Yeah. I want to do a whole thing on how neither of our parties are two parties at this point.
Right. It's actually like four. Right. You got the extreme wings, and then you got the centrist wings of each party, and we go from there. All right. Anyway,
yeah,
sorry.
Exactly.
I didn't mean to interrupt the flow, but I want to make sure I was properly characterizing what I thought that you thought that I thought that you thought that I thought you said. okay, so
I like those
that was The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. It was, I'm just going to say it, a grind. I frankly still think we should have come up with Man in the High Castle now, but
we didn't.
But we're gonna do a new poll in a couple of weeks. Pick some new books. Send us your submissions. makemesmart@marketplace.org, and let us know what you think we ought to have on the ballot, as it were, next time.
Yeah, I'm excited. Maybe we'll have to try to seed next week's show with some suggestions. I can tell you that I'm pretty stoked to finally get back to Blue Mars, which is the sequel to Red Mars, because I'm reading the Mars trilogy.
Well, you can't make us read a sequel without reading the initial.
No. I'm not suggesting that for our list. Right. I'm just saying that's what I'm going to read next.
Also, by the way,
I'm
completely going to cook the books on this poll. I'm just saying. I am just saying. I'm going to admit it right now.
Don't let Kai see the poll.
I don't know what those emails were about. It was just about adoption. No, I'm just kidding.
Unbelievable.
Anyway, that's all I got.
How about
right
if
now.
We reserve the right to veto books that we think are going to be too hard, even though the whole point of this is to get smarter? I'm just saying, this was the perfect book for us to read.
Kind
of. All right. Next up, we have some of your feedback. A great question based on Kai's rant from a few weeks ago. But first, we got to pay the bills.
All right, time for the mail.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
All right, let's see. What do we... Ed Hoban wrote, in a recent... I'm going to say Hoban. In a recent podcast, Kai gave his opinion that if you listen to or read the news, you need to follow both sides of the political divide. If I listen to Marketplace and NPR News and then scan or read Vox.com and Politico, I feel that I'm covering center-left. Mm-hmm. Would Kai offer suggestions for center-right?
I will. And you know, I've gotten a couple of tweets about this as well. People looking for podcasts, since I think we brought that up as well. So a couple of quick thoughts. Weekly Standard is an easy one. The American Interest is another one. If you're looking for audio and it's actually interesting to listen to him on his own channel, as it were, versus where you've seen him on CNN, Hugh Hewitt, who's made several appearances on CNN as a debate moderator. He does a radio show during the week, and then he sort of does a best of thing on weekends, and I forget what it's called. But if you just search Hugh Hewitt podcast, you get a broad spectrum of the right side of the dial, as it were. And then you branch out from there. But those are some easy ones to start with, I think.
Yeah, I follow. I mean, you pretty much have to follow Fox News. I mean, that's like a really obvious one. Yep. I follow the Conservative Review.
Yep.
Oh, here's another CR. One.
We've had her on the pod, Molly Hemingway from The Federalist.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
She's fantastic.
Yeah.
I follow Bill Kristol in the Weekly Standard and then a couple editors from Conservative Review.
Bill Kristol pains me. I'll just say that.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those I think I might unfollow. Well, it's sort of like if you follow Charles Blow, then you have to follow Bill Kristol.
Yeah, well, yep, that's true. Yep.
Kind of.
Yep.
I am trying to purge some of those... Some of those sources. And honestly, I find the Wall Street Journal to be very often the place that I am going to just kind of like try to triangulate the news. I've used this phrase before. It's like if I read a story in the New York Times and then I see a headline version of it in the HuffPo, I go to the Wall Street Journal to just get the sober version.
Totally.
I'm not going to lie.
No, that's absolutely
true. Not to disparage
true.
My former employer.
No, that's totally right. And the problem is one has to factor time for depth of knowledge, right? Because you can't possibly read everything that's out there. So you have to filter and curate. And I guess my thing is you just need to do it in a balanced way. Not a Fox News balanced way, but a real balanced way.
Well, and you just have to not get... Yeah, I just don't... You know what? Actually, one of the probably, even though it seems like the lamest solution in the book, back to the book.
Yes.
One of the things that he very specifically says in the book is that we need to create time for contemplation. Research shows that 2 minutes of reflection on a good argument can actually change someone's mind.
Did you read the piece in the New York Times, a couple of months ago about David Leonhardt wrote a piece about how he takes an hour a day and just sits there with a pencil and a piece of paper?
Wow.
Like no phone.
That sounds lovely.
No Twitter, no nothing. And he just thinks big thoughts. And he got the idea from somebody else. But yeah, fascinating. I frankly don't think I have the mental discipline to do that, honestly.
Well, even 2 minutes, though, if you just stop, if you read a headline, right, and you are having an emotional reaction to it, just take 2 minutes to think to yourself, does this seem right?
Yeah.
Or I'm going to think of, or if you read a headline that you have an emotional reaction to because it's in the negative of what you think, take 2 minutes and think about the ways in which it might make sense.
Yeah. Especially the headlines that you don't agree with.
Especially,
always think about that. Yeah.
Don't read everything. Just don't do it. Don't immerse. I'm sorry, but it's bad for you. It is, as Zeynep Tufekci said, it is censorship by information overload.
Get a load of you. Oh, snap. All right.
It's all coming together, guys. The longer we do this podcast, the more we have to build on.
It says here in my rundown thing you have a clip. Do you have a clip?
Oh, I do have a clip. I also just want to end it with a clip because I was like a little worried about Kai after yesterday's editorial meeting.
Well, because it happens.
Yeah, because it happens. And
also, I had a big headache all day.
A little down. It's because you were wearing your specs. You can't just wear your specs around after wearing contacts.
That's probably true.
Yeah, it makes you all dizzy.
Yeah.
He was in the dark place, but also, and this is just a sort of a personal story, when I was in Montana, my grandmother, who's 94, was really sick and she had to go to the hospital. And it was a big, it was our first big scare with her because she's absurdly healthy. And she's going to be okay. And then later that day, I saw on Twitter, because it's not all bad, this great video of Macklemore taking his 100-year-old grandmother out for a day on the town and turning that into his music video. And then on top of that, the song is just a picker-upper. So I thought we could just play some in honor of your dark mood and my grandma.
All right.
Don't you feel better?
No, I do feel good. I feel better now. I feel better. I'm not dancing in the studio. Let's be clear. I'm not dancing. I don't dance.
I started to dance, but then my chair started squeaking, so I had to stop.
review us on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend. Subscribe. Follow us on Twitter, at Molly Wood, at Kai Rizdahl. Dance if you like. I won't judge.
Because here comes the music.
Oh, I know. And this is my best part of the show. It's my favorite part of the show. Which version are we going to get? Okay, it's not my favorite part of the show.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Nancy Fergali. This week's program was engineered by Brian Allison. Our theme music, which you are dancing to right now, is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. And a special thanks to our friend, singer-songwriter Marion Call. We had her on the show, and she's so wonderful. And she gifted us all of the music for this episode and said, quote, "It's the one way I can support public media."
Click on donate.
Thank you, Mary.
That's all you got to do. The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And it looks like we get the regular old music, not the fancy fun version. Just saying.
Take a note for next week, everyone.
Yeah, I'm not in charge of the music.
Kai wants to dance.
No.